Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I am Regina Maria Tillman. Today we go to the polls to hear what voters are saying about Troy's election.
Then we're joined by Karen Beadle of Ice Free Capital District.
And later on, your weekly episode of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics.
And after that, off to SUNY Albany for the United Nations anniversary.
Finally, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry on Dia de Muertos, the Day of the Dead. And first, headlines.
November 5th means Election Day, so if you're listening live this evening, make sure you get out and vote.
The Times Union reports that a newly filed lawsuit claims retired Albany Roman Catholic Bishop Howard Hubbard told a teenage boy more than 60 years ago that he should forget about it, quote-unquote, alleged sexual abuse he suffered at the hands of another priest who had what Hubbard allegedly described as a, quote, moment of weakness, unquote. Hubbard on Monday said that the accusations against him are false, as he was graduating from high school in June 1956. The Albany Diocese has been named as defendant in more than 50 sexual abuse claims. Included in that count are four separate lawsuits allegedly direct abuse by Hubbard, while others allege that the retired bishop and other
diocese.
Thank you. Officials knew of and allowed abuse to happen.
The City of Schenectady police sergeant who fired a shot through the driver's side window of a stolen car with two youngsters inside as it traveled towards him on a city street is scheduled to be interviewed by police investigators Tuesday as part of the department's internal probe into the confrontation. The Times Union reported that Otto Butler, president of the Schenectady NAACP, is seeking more information from the city about the details of the shooting before commenting.
Albany Common Council members Kelly Kimbrough and Jenny Farrell have been voted in as council president pro tempore and majority leader. Longtime president Richard Council announced his resignation last month after 15 years.
Hudson Valley Community College will celebrate Native American History Month with a performance on Thursday, November 7th, at the Piscataway Nation Singers and Dancers as they perform. The free event is noon to 1 p.m. in the Bulmer Telecommunications Center Auditorium.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary. Up now, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondents Andrea and Alexis spoke to voters at the polls in Troy. Andrea reports from 1600 7th Street and Alexis from Knickerbocker Arena.
You know, you go in there, you color your little circle, and you stick it in the machine, and you're done.
However,
there was a lot of people running on their own. There's like three or four people in Rensselaer County have no competition against them.
Do you think that's a good thing?
No, that's not good. Because we won't get change.
And we need change. Thank you.
All right.
What did you think of the whole voting process today?
Very good, very good.
With WOOC, which is the local radio station, I just wanted to know if you had a comment about this recent election or the voting process, or are you pleased to be voting today?
Oh, I vote every year, ever since I turned 21.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I think that people should show identification. I think that I have to show identification for everything else. And to not have to show identification to vote for anybody is just ludicrous.
Hi, did you vote?
Yes.
Could I just ask if you have a comment about your vote today?
I don't have a comment. I hope it matters. Whoever wins, I hope they don't win by a lot, honestly.
Why is that?
Because maybe if people are scared for their jobs, they'll do something different.
I'm very glad I voted. And it's good to see young people voting, too. So voting is a right, a privilege, and it's important.
I can't agree more with that. It's so important to cast your vote, because you never know.
I'm a Democrat. Not voted for Democrat today.
No, why is that?
I don't believe the mayor raised taxes too much. But downtown looks great. But we need roads fixed out here, too, not just downtown, so... And we're shortage a lot of police officers, so. And that came from my neighbor, who's the community watch program leader, president, so. She said Troy's down like 7 police officers, so. I know.
What do you hope the outcome of the election is?
The only outcome I want of the election is for more people to vote, so whatever happens then, happens then.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Would you like to tell WOC how you feel about this election?
I'm hoping it's going to make a better Troy.
And what would a better Troy be for you?
More police on the beat so we can get rid of these vandals that is going on with all the shootings and everything going on. Hopefully it will be better.
I live in Troy, have done for more than 30 years, and one of the things I find very disappointing about this election is that there were no early polling places open in Troy. That for people in the city who don't have transportation, it then became impossible to vote early. And I think that's a tremendous injustice. And if we're going to have early voting in the state, then it should be accessible for people everywhere.
How do you feel about this location, Knickerbocker Arena?
I think it's kind of ridiculous. There's not a sign to how to get here. As I said, I've lived in Troy for more than 30 years, and we've been voting here. We used to vote at school too, which was we could walk to from our home. To get here, I get lost every time I come. There is no signage. There's nothing that says polling place this way. It feels like Rensselaer County and Troy want to make it very hard for people to vote. I think that's what this place does.
How do you feel about this election?
I think that it's been a good turnout so far, and I hope to see more people. And I've seen a lot of young people, which is great. That's my favorite, because that's the future. And the more young people are involved, typically the more change comes about. So, and the city could use some change. So it's good to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
How do you feel about this location?
This location is busier than I expected, but it seems to be a little tough for some people to get here. It's not quite on like a bus route. So we're seeing maybe a few less people from some districts than others. But otherwise, it's pretty centrally located, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Do you want to just give a few thoughts on this election?
I'll be glad when it's over. And I pray that everybody pray before they went in there to pray for these candidates, because you want the right person to do the right job, to do the right things. You just don't want people just to go in there for notoriety. You know, say one thing and then turn around and come out with a power trip on the other side. You don't want that. You want somebody who's gonna have the communities in this city looking towards the future and not looking in the past. Because right now you have too much things that's been said during this debate and everything. Everything was at a past tense state. We all know what happened. We all know what can't happen. But the thing is, we all want to see something different to happen. We don't have that right now. Right now, we have chaos. We have division. We have spiteful words, and there's nothing that's really constructive. Nothing really constructive about this whole thing. We just want to know that and be able to sleep at night and knowing that whoever is in charge of certain departments in this city and districts are capable enough to do their job, capable enough to get out and go out here and talk to the people when the people are hurting. Go out there to reassure them that things can get better if we all can work together. Because that's the main thing, is really working together. You can have the office and the money, but you got to come out here and work together with the communities.
I don't know. I vote, but it's just, you know.
You said after the recording?
That I heard. It's all over our work. I work for the county.
Which recording are you referring to?
Oh, the county exec and the other guy there, Real.
The one with McLaughlin?
Yeah. I didn't know who the other guys were, only Real. I don't know who the other guys that he was talking before McLaughlin came in on it. Nothing's much probably going to happen from it. That's too bad, but, you know. I just joke when I can't leave without a joke. I said, am I all right? Am I safe in here? Because, you know, it says they said it's cutthroat politics and it's rough and, you know.
We still came to vote. Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know, because I guess one person in our household votes, and it's me. But I voted since I was 18, that's why. Because, you know, your right to vote. You know.
Are you hopeful about the outcome?
I think they just made the Democrat, the mayor, going to win. I think they made him win by that, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not too knowledgeable about politics, but I think I wanted the guy they were pushing on the tape for. I still voted for him, but before that, mm-hmm. before I heard that, I feel the mayor now hasn't done much. I live in the burg. Crime is, I don't know where they say crime is down. I don't know if they live in Clifton Park. There's murders up where I live all the time. There's murders. There was a bank robbery. One week there was a bank robbery or murder. No, it's just crime isn't down, you know. And then the streets are dirty. Potholes. I grew up in South Troy, and it's 2 years without pools. If I didn't have that pool when I was a kid, we'd have been in a lot of trouble because we lived in that pool all day.
Thanks to HMM correspondent Alexis and Andrea for reporting on the voting in Troy.
In this segment, Hudson Mohawk correspondent Brandon Miller speaks to Karen Beadle, the co-coordinator of Capital District Border Watch, about the upcoming events related to detention centers and the refugee crisis at the border of the United States.
Welcome. We have Karen Beadle in the studio. Karen is the co-coordinator of the Capital District Border Watch, and we're really happy to have you in the studio today to tell us several of the events that your organization is working on.
Great. It's great to be here.
It's going to be a busy month, but before we hear about those events, could you tell us a little bit about the Capital District Border Watch, the history of the organization, and your role as the co-coordinator?
Okay, yeah. Capital District Border Watch came together in February of 2019, and we came together out of organizing that was happening around the family detentions, really beginning a year earlier in May when Trump began officially separating families at the border, and there was a lot of activism and clarity about the need to stop that. And that organizing wasn't happening on an ad hoc basis, and we decided to really gather together. And Capital District Border Watch included me and Carrie Keel, who was running a small Amnesty International chapter. So Carrie and I decided to get this organization off the ground, and she and I are working on it together.
That's wonderful. And I'm sure everybody who's listening would like to know the events that you've been planning for this upcoming month. The first one is called Witness at Tornillo, and it is happening Tuesday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. at Landmark Spectrum 8 Theater. Could you tell us, what is that film?
Great. So Witness at Tornillo follows Josh Rubin, who was one of the people who decided that he was going to create a personal witness at the Tornillo facility, which was housing children who were being detained. And he went from his presence at Tornillo to Homestead and maintained a presence there. And he was very committed to the idea that these children should not feel alone, that we were not able to end detention yet in the U.S. in terms of migrant children, young children being detained in prison-like conditions. But he wanted to hold up hearts on stepladders and and wave at the children every chance he could, so that there was an ongoing sense that there was an alternative presence here. There were people in the United States who were opposing these policies, and they were going to remain present and committed to making sure these children knew they weren't alone. And so this is a documentary describing his journey to that witness that went on for many months for him. We're holding it at the Spectrum Landmark Theater. That's November 12th, Tuesday. And we are selling tickets to that. We have 23 tickets left as we speak. So we've had an amazing, amazing response to this.
And I think it's especially important that this is a person who was from New York, like us, in
yep.
this listening audience, who felt compelled to go to Texas
right.
to do something about
right.
it.
Yeah.
Is that how the people in the Capital District Border Watch feel, that they just need to do something?
Well, I think our big commitment was that the border isn't over 1,000 miles away. The border exists right here in the community. In the ethical stance that our government has taken means that as people of conscience, we're all responsible for what's happening at the border. We have undocumented families living here in the Capital Region, living in fear. The ICE policies have caused huge rapids throughout the country. And one of the first things that we did as Capital District Border Watch is we actually made a border fence out of chicken wire, and we take it to all our demonstrations, and we have blown up photos of children and statements by children in detention. So we want to make this border fence visible in the Capital Region so that people can't look away from what's happening.
Really important strategy that gives us a kind of empathetic response to what's happening. And the next event that the Capital District Border Watch is sponsoring is Nowhere to Go, Barriers to Asylum and the Refugee Crisis in Mexico, which is a community forum to learn more about the rapidly changing asylum and humanitarian crisis on the southern border and inside Mexico. Could you share with us this upcoming community forum?
What's really important to know is a few months ago, we were seeing a lot of people, pictures of people in detention being held under a bridge in El Paso, Texas. Some of the first statements of children were released talking about not being able to feel their hearts. So we were getting a lot of pictures, a lot of visibility about what happened at the border. And so Trump's goal is to really enact a policy that's aimed at really destroying the legal rights of people seeking asylum. And so he's looking to end asylum as a concept, really. And so when we talk about challenging these policies, we're challenging this denial of the right to be a seeker of asylum, right? So these are people who are fleeing dangerous conditions, who need to be able to come to a safe haven, right? And so what's really important for people to understand right now is these detention camps in the U.S. are not filling up right now because the Remain in Mexico policy, the first policy that he enacted that made people wait in Mexico and put their names in this book to be on this trickle-in process into the United States, was already leaving people in tent-like facilities in Matamoros, in Ciudad Juarez, in Tijuana, in places that were really not very safe to be. So that got exacerbated when the Supreme Court upheld Trump's policy to not let refugees from the Northern Triangle into the United States, because he was claiming that they could apply for asylum in the countries en route. And he got Guatemala to agree that it was a safe country for refugees from further south to be applying for asylum in. So now nobody from Honduras, from El Salvador, from Guatemala can apply for asylum in the United States unless they have applied in one of these quote unquote safe third countries and been denied asylum. So right now there are 40 to 50,000 people backed up at the border who have nowhere to go. There's no process by which they can apply for asylum. They've basically been denied the right to apply for asylum. And so as people are trying to figure out what to do about these policies,
we're not any longer really drawing attention to detention facilities in the U.S. We're drawing attention to the fact that there are 40 to 50,000 people in very, very dangerous conditions at the border. So the two threads that we really want the community to understand is to really look at what's happened to asylum. So we have Sarah Rogerson, the director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School, and she's keeping a very up-to-date sense of what's happening through the caseload at the law school, and also by looking at the policies and how these things are moving through the courts right now. So Sarah's going to come and give us an up-to-date sense of what's happening in the legal system around asylum. And we just got word this week that Ashoka Mukpo, who's a staff reporter for the ACLU, who recently went down and interviewed asylum seekers in Matamoros and Ciudad Juarez, is going to come up from New York and really talk about what conditions people are facing, what is the gang activity and the human trafficking and the hardships, the specific hardships that people at the border are facing. And the idea behind this is to bring together people from the capital region to have a conversation about what do we do now.
Thank you. And the third event that you're doing this month is the Infiltrators, which is on December 4th. And could you just give us a snapshot of that? And we will invite you back to talk more intensely about how you're organizing the community for that event.
Great. We're really looking forward to collaborating with the Sanctuary for Independent Media on The Infiltrators. It's a fantastic film about the empowerment of young undocumented dreamers.
Thank you so much, Karen Beadle, for all the work you're doing with Capital District Border Watch and the many other networks that you're activating to help in this community.
Thanks, Brenda.
That was Karen Beadle speaking about the Capital District Border Watch events. These events, witnessed at Tornillo and Nowhere to Go, Barriers to Asylum and Refugee Crisis in Mexico, will be occurring a week apart in the capital area starting next Tuesday, November 12th. The final event will be the Infiltrators, a screening at the Sanctuary for Independent Media of the film by Alex Rivera.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Regina Tillman. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine at the Hudson Mohawk Radio station WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics is back. And Dr. David Borton is back. On this week's episode, solar boat builder and physicist, Dr. Borton discusses the magic of bronze with WOOC friend Megan.
Hey, Dr. Borton.
Hey, Megan. How are you? It's been a while.
It's been a while, but you were flying over some continents.
Well, not whole continents exactly, but I had a trip to Greece because my wife's grade school friends hadn't seen each other for 60 years, and they had a reunion in Greece. So that was a good excuse to go visit a place that's got a huge amount of history.
Did you see things from the Bronze Age when you were there?
Stone Age stuff and Bronze Age stuff and everything after that. It's really quite impressive.
I know you're a physics person, but are you one of those people who you really have all of those ages down in your mind? Like, you know, the difference in time between, like, the order of the Stone Age, Bronze Age, the Megalithic period, the Neolithic period?
No, I don't have those dates in my head, but I have the technology sort of in my head because a lot of Greece was made with stones. Doing construction with stones is really quite impressive. If you think about construction these days, we have materials that are very uniform, man-made materials. But if you have a stone that wasn't man-made, but men can figure out the strength of those materials approximately, and like make a lintel over a door, and how do you know how strong to make it? Well, now we have easy ways to measure that kind of thing, a steel and wood. Back then they didn't, and so it was trial and error and experience that was learned over generations and handed down from person to person, that if you're going to make a 6-foot lintel across a door, you need to have a stone that's this kind and this thick, or if it's this other kind of stone, it needs to be thicker or thinner. So that's a lot of knowledge that was generated before science really was around to do that.
Passed down through word of mouth.
Yeah, and experience. If you have a rock and you're pounding another rock, and your kids come along and they pound rocks, and the kids see that you made something useful and they need the same thing, they're going to decide fairly quickly that, you know, I'd better learn how to do this if I want a house of my own.
Did your kids watch you when you've been making solar boats? Were you examined closely, where people were like, okay, that's how you cold bend this, that's where you put the solar panels?
Yes, but not just making boats, cutting down trees, making firewood, building things out of lumber. All of those things require some knowledge of how materials operate under forces, gravitational forces being the main ones to play.
Have you ever done any smithing, metalwork?
I've done a little bit, and actually I'm going to do some more. I'm going to start making bronze. We'll realize that bronze was stronger than wooden spears and wooden swords, and that gave the technological advantage to armies that use bronze. And bronze is beautiful stuff, and bronze is very good in boats because it is not corroding the way other things corrode.
What do you think you're going to make out of bronze?
Eventually, I think I'd like to make some boat components, oarlocks, cleats, that kind of thing. But the first things I'll probably make would be very simple plaques that are cast into a simple mold.
Cool. How come that's the first thing?
Because it sounds like the easiest thing.
You can make a plaque pretty easily.
Well, yeah, you just have to make a depression. You know, you could use any depression in any rock and pour bronze, liquid bronze into it, but that's not very artistic. If you now carve something and maybe you make it in clay and you fire it and then you pour the bronze into that clay, or you make a sand mold and pour the bronze into that, then you've made something.
What are the dates of the Bronze Age? Do you know?
No, I don't have that in my head.
It was a while ago.
It was a while ago. People occasionally found copper. And copper occasionally appears in its native form, meaning elemental copper. Now, elemental copper is fairly soft, and so you can't really make a good sword out of copper. But you can alloy it with tin, and the alloy makes bronze, and that's a stronger material. And then, you know, you've really got some strength in your materials. So that makes a better sword.
I'm looking around this room to see if I have anything that's bronze. I sometimes forget what bronze is. Like copper, I can recall immediately. And I know copper has naturally antibiotic properties to it. But bronze, I know a bit less about. I guess I think of it as being part of old warfare because it is a heavy, it's a strong metal.
Okay, well, what about brass? What do you know about brass? Brass is copper with zinc.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and bronze is a little stronger. It's copper with tin and a little more durable. But all of those alloys are better than copper alone.
No, it's interesting. I've been thinking about metalwork because I have ancestors that were all blacksmiths, and thinking about how plastics came along and replaced the need for metalwork around the middle 20th century, you know, especially in the 70s and the 80s. It was just like everybody wanted plastic siding on their homes. You know, it was just seen as the more economically friendly and trendy and durable thing. So it's just interesting to me, this whole idea of metalwork and bending metal. Like, do you have the tools to actually, you know, work with the metal and heat it?
One of the things I wanted was a broad axe. Do you know what a broad axe is?
No, but it sounds cool.
It's cool. Regular axe is symmetrical, and so it's good for chopping wood or splitting wood. But if you want to hewing wood, you want to cut the side off the wood. So it's better to have an asymmetrical axe head. And so I've actually made those. I heated the steel on the electric burner in the kitchen, and then I took it outside and put it on a stump and pounded on it with a hammer and shaped a broad axe.
Was it good for hewing?
Yes, it was. It still is. I still have it.
So could it be possible to ever have an all-bronze solar boat?
Oh, yeah, but a metal boat, well, boats are made of steel now. A bronze boat would be fairly expensive.
Fairly glorious, right?
Yeah, okay. Well, that's not an idea I had thought of. It would be easier to use copper sheet, which is a little more ductile, a little weaker, but still strong enough. So you could make a copper boat probably easier than you could make a bronze boat.
Yeah, you'd have to work with the conduction in different ways on a bronze boat.
Well, a little bit, yes. But have you ever been in your car in the summertime with the windows closed?
Yeah.
Yeah, that gets pretty hot. Steamy. So a bronze boat's not going to get significantly hotter than that. So that's not a problem.
What do you think, in terms of discovering how to use bronze, how do you think that happened for ancient peoples? Was it just trial and error?
If you find some native copper and you're playing around with native copper and you make nice things with it, but you find it's not so ductile, I mean, it's too ductile for some things. And then you find that, well, hey, here's some of this other stuff called tin. And if you heat them together, you get something that's stronger than the copper. You know, people are pretty smart to figure things out like that. Even call it proto-science. It's a scientific approach to things without the modern quantification that we have of science.
Oh, yeah. And I totally respect that. You know, I think that that's the beauty of anthropology, is going back and really looking at that.
Yeah, well, that takes us back to the rocks, you know. Mm-hmm. How do you figure out how strong a rock is for a given use? Well, you do some experiments and you learn, and the same thing happened with bronze. And then iron came along, and that another stronger material. Steel is useful for many more things than just plain iron, and that's an alloy. So people figure these things out.
Well, we're going to be looking at your solar boats at the Waterford Boat Festival now and saying, where's the bronze? Where are the plaques? Where are the bronze boat oars? The listenership is going to hold your feet to the fire about this.
Well, it does take pretty hot fire to melt bronze. So that's a good analogy. You know, you can't do everything. You haven't taught me how. what do I do first? Do I cut up rock? Do I make bronze? Do I make another boat? You know, there's too many things on the to-do list.
So, Walt, do you have any final comments on my order for an opal and amethyst and bronze solar boat?
Well, I think you'd have to get in line. I think there are some things that'll come before that.
Well,
so
wait till you see it coming down the Hudson.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Dr. Borton.
Well, Megan, it's always fun. This was a little different.
Thanks once again to Megan Marone and Dr. David Borton. Tune in next week for another installment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics.
Troy resident Christian Rigoroskos spoke about the imminent threat of the climate crisis on behalf of Extinction Rebellion at the United Nations Association event, the 74th anniversary United Nations Day celebration.
Good afternoon, folks. It's great to be here. On behalf of Extinction Rebellion, I want to thank you all for having us. So my name is Christian Grigoroskos.
Hi.
And this is Ember, my son.
Hello.
MB. I knew this was going to happen. Anyway, I live in Troy. I'm a tree-hugging arborist by trade, but more importantly, I'm a husband, a father, a radical gardener, and a member of the human race. For most of the last decade, I've been living a lifestyle that attempts to harmonize with the natural world and hold a deep reverence for her complex systems that support all life. This began with a training in permaculture design, which is essentially an articulation of many global indigenous land stewardship systems and self-governance practices. Permaculture taught me about true sustainability as found in nature, which is basically any non-polluting system, zero waste, if you will. I was led to some heavy revelations about our extremely poorly designed global economy, which views nature as an externality, if you're familiar with economic theory, and as a result creates unacceptable amounts of pollution, destroying ecosystems in the process, rendering the whole system unsustainable. So anyhow, I went along with the belief that growing your own food is one of the most subversive acts and was happy to promote that kind of activism. In recent years, though, I started to catch wind of the overwhelming scientific evidence that the Earth's systems are breaking due to human activity. I'm going to assume that most of you here today understand the basics of human-caused climate change and can accept this fact. We host regular talks at Extinction Rebellion that are titled Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It, which dives into the details of the science. And if you'd like to host this talk at your organization, we'd love to make it happen. Just get in touch with us. You can also find many versions of the talk online, but best to watch it in a group setting. For me, one of the most alarming facts about the climate crisis is that we have emitted equal amounts of carbon dioxide from 2006 until now as we did from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution about 200 years ago until 2006. Now, I mentioned 2006 because that's the year that Al Gore's mainstream documentary on global warming, An Inconvenient Truth, was released. An analogy of this situation would be as if you're driving towards a cliff and you decided to step on the gas. But we can't blame humans. The real blame is to be placed on greed, ill will, and delusion. This was reminded to me by a Buddhist monk who I spent the day in jail with, along with 50 other people a few weeks ago after being arrested for blocking a road in Lower Manhattan. One of the principles of Extinction Rebellion, thanks. One of the principles of Extinction Rebellion is no blaming or shaming, so we're not going to blame people. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change gave its first report in 1990, 30 years ago. I was 7 years old. And it outlined the dangers of inaction. And yet, over the last 30 years, no real action has been taken. In fact, we're making the situation worse. Last year's even more urgent IPCC report warned us to reduce emissions to keep from heating the Earth beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius. More realistic estimates have us locked in to 2.3, even up to 3 degrees Celsius. So now we have governments, including New York State, claiming they will reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2050, another 30 years out. That's 70 election cycles in the current political system. This effort towards mass societal change is now more than twice as difficult as if we had begun taking action when we knew about the seriousness of the issue. And by many measures, the IPCC is a conservative report. So a few hundred years of this extremely poorly designed system of free market capitalism, masquerading in recent decades as neoliberalism, has resulted in nearly destroying the planet and causing massive amounts of human suffering just to make a handful of people and corporations extremely wealthy and powerful. As I understand it, Milton Friedman, one of the architects of neoliberalism, possibly believed that his free market theory would not produce income inequality because the same freedoms, as opposed to rights, that's the debate, would be afforded to every individual. If widespread freedom was really his aim, I would consider this type of economic strategy to be an utter failure. Corporations have become so powerful, in fact, that they have essentially seized control over major world governments and mainstream media outlets. If this was not the case, Their profit motives would not be winning out over public safety, and we might not find ourselves in this complete collective mess. The government has all governments have a social contract with its citizens to keep us safe. Since they are doing nothing to stop the polluting industries that are leading to our extinction, it is safe to say that this contract is broken, and we have the right to rebel. Or as Thomas Jefferson put it, when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. So, how does it feel to be in the middle of the sixth mass extinction? I wish that was a rhetorical question. Honestly, I wish I was wrong about all this. But a report by WWF, the World Wildlife Federation, last year said that since 1970, we have wiped out 60% of all animal life on Earth due to our growing consumption of food and resources. We, too, are part of the animal kingdom. I'll tell you how it feels for me. Sadness, anger, despair, grief, cynicism, guilt, but also joy and elation in embracing moments deemed all the more precious because of the situation. Just about every emotion one can feel when confronting grave uncertainty and our own death. I think this is an issue that needs to be felt by all of us. It will ultimately lead us to feel love for each other and our beautiful planet, and courage in knowing we are not alone. Courage to face this Goliath head on, knowing full well we might fail. It is constantly on my mind how and when this will all fall apart. When will it be too late? Will it be widespread famine or overwhelming heat? A catastrophic methane release? The heavy hand of a fascist regime? Then I realized that the single factor that will end it all is the people who know what is at stake and did not do anything at all. I refuse to be one of those people. I refuse to give in to fear and instead choose love to be the guide. It is time, now more than ever, to lead a purpose-driven existence and be part of the human community, and at the least, try to preserve life for future generations. So what to do? Based on social science research of transformative movements of the last century, such as Gandhi, Martin Luther King, the American suffragettes, Extinction Rebellion arrived at the very well thought out conclusion that mass participation in sustained acts of nonviolent civil disobedience offer us the best odds of effecting real systemic change. This means disrupting business as usual until it becomes too expensive to ignore us, blocking roads and bridges in major cities, occupying financial institutions and other entities that support toxic industries, overwhelming government buildings with people demanding change and refusing to leave until an action plan is provided, all while maintaining a nonviolent discipline. That's the real important part. These actions are already bringing people together all over the world, connecting deeply on the grounds of our basic humanity and love for each other and future generations. As Greta Thunberg said, there are no rules for keeping fossil fuels in the ground, so we cannot save the world by playing by the rules. We are politely but firmly saying enough is enough. What makes me most hopeful about Extinction Rebellion's strategy is that social science shows that we only need a target of 3.5% of the population engaged to achieve our goal. Essentially, it's a numbers game. If we can overwhelm the system to truly let it know we are fed up with it, then the system has to change. So Extinction Rebellion has four demands on how to get the transformation of society going. Number one, tell the truth. Governments must tell the truth by declaring a climate and ecological emergency, working with other institutions to communicate the urgency for change. Number two, governments must act now to halt biodiversity loss and reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2025. This requires nothing short of wartime mobilization. Number three, governments must create and be led by the decisions of a citizens' assembly on climate and ecological justice. This leaves the policy decisions in the hands of the people and not the governments. And the fourth demand is that we demand a just transition that prioritizes the most vulnerable people and establishes indigenous sovereignty, establishes reparations and remediation led by and for Black people, indigenous people, people of color, and poor communities for years of environmental injustice, establishes legal rights for ecosystems to thrive and regenerate in perpetuity, and repairs the effects of ongoing ecocide to prevent extinction of humanity and all species in order to maintain a livable and just planet for all. It's heavy. I encourage you and all your family and friends to start having the tough conversations that need to be had and get involved in transforming society for the benefit of future generations. We are a decentralized and autonomous organization, so as long as you maintain the nonviolent discipline and follow the principles set forth, you can call yourself Extinction Rebellion. Our website in the Capital Region is xrcr.life. I encourage you to watch the many informative and educational YouTube videos on the Extinction Rebellion channel if you need further convincing that the time is now to stand up for the world we want to see. I hope to see you all out on the streets and some of you in jail really soon. Thank you.
That was Christian Grigorascos on the threat of the climate change.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network's roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, attended Hudson Valley Community College Dia de Muertos, a discussion of Mexican tradition on Tuesday, October 29th. Associate Professor Malu Benton and instructor Nestor Guardado led the discussion on Mexican tradition of the Day of the Dead.
This is Willie Terry, your Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent, and today I'm here at Hudson Valley Community College where they had a discussion about Mexican tradition. I have as my guest today to discuss that Professor
Nestor Guardado
and Professor
Malu Benton.
All right, Malu Benton. How y'all doing?
Good.
All right.
Fine. How are you?
All right, all right. So I see that you had a nice crowd in here.
Yes.
You was talking about the Day of the Dead. What is the Day of the Dead?
Well, it's a Mexican tradition, a Mexican observance, if you will. It's a day when Mexicans remember their dead loved ones.
And what date is it celebrated? I mean, what is the actual date?
November 2nd.
Oh, just on one date?
Well, yes, that's the Day of the Dead.
Oh, okay.
The observance begins before, mm-hmm. perhaps since October, people start getting prepared, and it continues into mid-November or the third week of November. But the actual day that everybody's waiting for is November 2nd.
Oh, okay. And how is it celebrated?
Well, it's celebrated by either if a family observes it, they'll set up an ofrenda, which is like an altar of an offering that they're making to their dead loved ones to come back to visit. And so they'll place, you know, items that, you know, remind that family of that person. So it would be a photograph of them, some dishes that that person liked to eat in life to kind of, you know, have them come in.
And I noticed you have an altar here at the library downstairs. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that particular altar.
Well, that altar, we tried, especially altars that are placed in public places, they're non-secular, so they don't tend to have a lot of religious, you know, artifacts, whereas in a house, if the family was religious, you wouldn't have crucifix, you have, you know, votive candles with saints on them, anything religious, really. Mm-hmm. But in a public place, you try to respect, you know, other people's beliefs, because not everybody is Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very, very colorful day. You know? And it's a lot of colors involved with it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, most of the things you see downstairs are were brought directly from Mexico. Mm-hmm. We bought them there and brought them. I've been bringing things, you know, for years and years. I go back home three times a year, or at least twice a year. After my semester's done here, I have a plane to catch, and I go back to Mexico. And every time I'm there, I try to bring something extra for the altar. So, yeah, most of what you see down there comes directly from Mexico, those colorful things, yeah.
You know, what I meant to ask you before I got into the discussion about the other day, is tell me something about yourself. You know, you're a professor here. Tell me something about your life here as a professor and how you got here.
Oh, well,
I... What you teach?
Okay, I've been at Hudson Valley for almost 14 years now. I teach Spanish, Italian, French, and English as a second language. Mm-hmm. And I'm also one of the ESL advisors.
Were you born in Mexico?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in Mexico. Mm-hmm. I came to the U.S. because I married an American.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And tell me something about yourself.
I teach various English composition courses here at the college in the English department. I've only really studied the literature at university, but here what brought me here would be my college studies. Mm-hmm. And for myself, I was also born in Mexico, but I was raised in California, Los Angeles area.
So what part of Mexico did you come from?
My family is from the state of Zacatecas.
Okay.
Yep.
And you are from?
I'm from Guadalajara, in the state of Jalisco. Yeah, yeah, which is the second largest city in Mexico is Guadalajara. Uh-huh. It's a very, very big city, the size of New York City.
Now, do your family celebrate the Day of the Dead? You know, is that traditional every year?
No. No. All Mexicans are aware of the tradition. Mm-hmm. We know it exists, mm-hmm. but not everybody observes it.
But is this important? You know, I mean, this is a school that bringing in international students, too.
Right.
And is it important that they know about all aspects of other diversities and countries?
Of course, yes. Of course. Mm-hmm. This contributes to create awareness. Mm-hmm. About Mexican customs, and we have a lot of international students. We have people who come from all corners of the world. It's very nice to be able to share this with them.
Yeah, it promotes, you know, this constant learning that we learn from each other, not mm-hmm. just, you know, from one, you know, reigning culture, but all cultures, even if it's not your own. It's still a wonderful opportunity to learn about it.
Mm-hmm. What is the origin of this is a holiday, the Day of the Dead.
Well, I know there are like similar elements that existed in pre-Columbian days, pre-Columbian as in before Columbus. Mm-hmm. And so I know that the Aztecs, they definitely believed in still remembering their dead loved ones. And they didn't really have a cemetery like we do today. Right. If anything, they would bury their dead in unsealed tombs under their homes. So that way they could still visit them, even converse with them, if you will. So that way, yes, they're deceased, but they're still with us. They're still part of our life. They're still. You know.
Now, within the celebration, I know there are food involved, right?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Now, what kind of food is involved with this particular celebration?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is pan de muerto. Mm-hmm. This is a special kind of bread that mm-hmm. it's baked only around this time of the year. Mm-hmm. It's very good. Pan de muerto, hot chocolate. You usually have pan de muerto with hot chocolate. So we have some mm-hmm. spicy hot chocolate here today. And then, you know, traditional dishes.
And I noticed that all the costumes they have, you yeah. count like
the skeleton.
The skeleton. Yeah, and it's almost mm-hmm. only time of Halloween. Yeah, is there a similarity between Halloween and Day of the Dead?
Well, there seems to be a time coincidence, Halloween being on October 31st and Day of the Dead on November 2nd. But the origins of both traditions are very different. Halloween mm-hmm. is an occasion for, you know, parties, organized parties, people wear costumes. It's very different. Whereas Day of the Dead, the idea, the behind Day of the Dead is people remembering their dead loved ones. Mm-hmm. So yes, there might wear customs, there might be parades, but what people who observe this tradition in Mexico do is remember.
Now, is this celebrated just in Mexico? Is there other maybe Spanish-speaking communities where is it celebrated, or is it celebrated any place in America?
Oh yeah, other Hispanic countries celebrate it too. Well, perhaps the most But the ones that have the biggest celebrations are Guatemala. Mm-hmm. Puerto Rico has something also. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, but it's not as big as it is in Mexico. So it's mainly associated with Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely popping up in Spanish-speaking, you know, neighborhoods here in the U.S., like in the Southwest, like California.
Oh, yeah.
You know. So it's definitely, it almost seems like almost like a reawakening, mm-hmm. of returning to one's roots and noticing where we're from, you know, and just preserving that. Right. So it's not lost. Even though, yes, we were raised in this country, but we're still Mexican at heart. Our blood is still Mexican, so.
Is there other thing that we might be looking forward to in the future?
Well, from us, is it will be Day of the Dead 2020.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We plan a series of events. Yes, so like movie showings and this talk and
maybe a more informative even film, as opposed to not just, you know, Coco for entertainment, but also like a documentary film style, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the curriculum itself here at the school? I mean, is there, would that be Hispanic courses? I'm just wondering, you know, to get students to understand the culture and the language.
Well, we have our foreign language classes are all include culture too. They have a cultural component. So actually, the full name of a Spanish classes I teach is Spanish Language and Culture. Mm-hmm. And we have four levels, Spanish Language and Culture 1, 2, 3, and 4. So definitely this is a cultural aspect that complements those classes. Also, we have several anthropology classes, and they seem to be interested. And, you know, cultural anthropology touches this type of topic. So
I've also heard in some of the meetings about how they're thinking of possibly finding ways to diversify the material to reflect the student population in the courses themselves so they can identify with it. So that's a possible way or an angle of possibly including some of culture into the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm a student, mm-hmm. you know, Latino descent or Hispanic descent, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about some college to go to, you know, mm-hmm. and I can't go out of state per se, what would you say about Hudson Valley, why I should come to Hudson Valley?
It's a fantastic place. It has a very, very friendly atmosphere. I used to work at SUNY Albany before coming here, and when I started working here, I was convinced I found the place where I want to retire from. The curriculum is excellent. Our professors are very dedicated. We have small classes, and we get the opportunity to learn our students' names. Mm-hmm. We are a community. So the academic level is excellent. So I definitely would encourage you to enroll at Hudson Valley.
Yes, before here I taught at the College of St. Rose in Albany, and even though that's a small liberal arts college, the school has an even smaller feel to it, a more intimate feel, where you really get to know your teachers, you get to know your classmates, you really feel like you're not just a number or a name on a roll list somewhere, you're actually an active learner in this community.
But I want to thank you for this interview. I know it's a spur of the moment, but thank you. And hopefully I could talk to you some more in the future about things, you know, Latino or Hispanic origin. Okay?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Willie Terry reporting on the Hudson Valley Community College discussion of Day of the Dead.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Regina Maria Tillman.
And I'm Eric Newton. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by at our weekly meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, we thank you for tuning in.